Welcome to Poetry Lectures, featuring talks by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, Australian poet Les Murray speaks with American poet Kevin Young. Les Murray is considered one of Australia's greatest contemporary poets and has won numerous literary awards. He was born in 1938 in New South Wales on a farm he moved back to with his own family in 1985. Murray often writes about Australian history and landscape and life in the rural areas. His work is praised for its inventive use of language and sense of humor. In addition to his poetry, Murray is a prolific author of essays, criticism, and fiction, and is the editor of many anthologies of poetry. Kevin Young was born in 1970 in Lincoln, Nebraska. While a student at Harvard, he became a member of the Darkroom Collective and later earned an MFA from Brown University. He has published many books of poetry, including Ardency, A Chronicle of the Amistad Rebels, and Dear Darkness, and has edited many anthologies. Young's book of essays and criticism, The Gray Album, won the 2013 Pen Open Award. Les Murray talks about the tradition of artistic hoaxes in Australia, including a fake modernist poet. He reads some excerpts from his work and tells how he hid his Catholic faith from his father and reveals other family secrets. The conversation took place at the Poetry Foundation in Chicago in April 2013.
Well, it's a real pleasure meeting you, having written with you just briefly, but having read your work for years and admired it. We were talking about sort of where we were from, and you're from the same patch of land where you grew up, is that right? Tell me a little about it.
It's a valley about 8 miles wide by about 8 miles long, and it's called Bunya, about 200 miles north of Sydney. It's lovely to talk in miles. We use kilometres these days, but in America I can talk miles.
And what's the landscape like?
It's low hills in the middle and quite reasonably high hills around the edges. It's a sort of cupped valley where the land starts to go up off the coastal plain into the mountains. You would probably say it's the geographical equivalent of the Appalachians.
Uh-huh.
Maybe not just the geographical equivalent of the Appalachian.
The emotional and...
Well, certainly in the past, not so much now.
Well, I was wondering about origins. We had written, and I was doing this food anthology, and you had mentioned, you didn't have many food poems, which I found incredible because there's so many great ones, the Broad Bean Sermon and, Pure Food, that poem about sort of laws and food. And I'm just sort of wondering how your home place... and food, the Broad Bean Sermon especially seems about that. Is that what it's about your home place?
No, it was a garden I had in Sydney.
Oh, okay.
We had a garden in the backyard, and I think I must have exhausted it because the beans were never as good again.
Well, is that a poem you wouldn't mind reading, or do you?
I wouldn't mind reading it. Yeah. Broad Bean Sermon, sure. Beanstalks, in any breeze, are a slack church parade without belief, saying, trespass against us, in unison. Recruits in mint Air Force Dacron with unbuttoned leaves. Upright with water like men, square in stem section, they grow to great lengths, drink rain, keel over all ways, kink down and grow up afresh with proffered new green stuff. Above the cat and mouse floor of a thin bean forest, snails hang wrapped in their food. Ants hurry through several dimensions. Spiders tense and sag like little black flags in their cordage. Going out to pick beans with the sun high as fence tops, you find plenty and fetch them. An hour or a cloud later, your fine shirt fulls more. At every hour of daylight appear more that you missed. Ripe, knobbly ones, fleshy-sided. Thin, straight, thin, crescent, frown-shaped, bird-shouldered, boat-keeled ones. Beans knuckled and single-bulged, minute green dolphins that suck. Beans upright like lecturing, outstretched like blessing fingers in the incident light. And more still, oblique to your notice, that the noon glare or cloud light or afternoon slants will uncover. Till you ask yourself, could I have overlooked so many, or do they form in an hour? Unfolding into reality like templates for subtly broad grins, like unique court expressions. Like edible meanings, each sealed around with a string and affixed to its moment. An unceasing colloquial assembly, the portly, the stiff, and those lolling in pointed green slippers. Wondering who'll take the spare bag fools you grin with happiness. It is your health. You vow to pick them all, even the last few, weeks off yet, misshapen as toes.
What a great poem.
Thank you.
How did you put it? There's such a prodigiousness there, and it's almost, is it an Ars Poetica, a poem about poetry, you think?
You can see it that way. I didn't think of it at the time as an Ars Poetica, but I thought of it as an Ars, I can't think of the Latin word for bean off the top of my head.
Well, but it's an unceasing colloquial assembly.
Yeah.
Portly the stiff. I mean, it's kind of a congregation of these beans.
Yeah.
How do you think that, does that describe your poetics too, or?
Oh, I hadn't written most of my poetics at the time. Well, maybe it was a forecast.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it is now. I mean, certainly I think it has this kind of generative quality, and your work is so prolific, which is a word I hate people sometimes ask me about, so I thought I'd ask you about prolificness. I mean, do you think of it in that way, or, you know, your collected poems are so vast?
No, I just do the next poem.
Yeah.
I suppose the thing I liked best in this poem was Prophet Near Green Stuff. Mm-hmm. I was very much after sound effects at the time.
Yeah.
And now I don't think about them much because they write themselves.
Yes.
They've learned to look after themselves.
Another early of your poems that I love is the Essays on Interest. The first and second essay on interest, the ones about the emu.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it's in this book, but you can lend me your book.
Sure. I love that poem. You know, maybe we can talk about it and then you could read it. But you talk about, well, in the first essay, you talk about this interest that blinks our interests out and alone permits their survival. And then you say, it is a form of love.
Yeah.
And in the second essay, you talk about emu. I think it's just a beautiful poem. Similarly, this idea of interest, what did you mean by interest there?
Oh, Lord, such a long time since I wrote it.
When are these from? I don't.
It was an analysis of a mental event, mental sort of process, you know, and I went on to do more of that sort of thing, partly in essays, you know, trying to work out an Ars Poetica for myself, you know, what happens when we write poetry. And I finally come to the idea that three things were involved, three minds that we've got. One's called the dreaming mind. Could be called anything, a number of other things, fantasy and so on. One's the rational daylight sort of reasoning mind. And one's the body, which then looks after dancing and gesture and a lot of forms of imagery and so on. And when they're in a kind of concert or fusion with each other, then poetry can exist.
Yeah. Is the emu all three?
I wasn't thinking of that then. It was before I thought of that thought, that stuff. I know, I was just fond of the emu.
Yeah, well, it's beautiful how you describe the emu. Then you said, now only life survives if it's made remarkable. We're remarkable and not. We're the ordinary discovered on a strange planet.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I was wrestling with various thoughts and paradoxes at the time. The emu is famous for being a curious bird. It doesn't fly, but it gobbles things down, swallows them, and it never chokes on them. And people think, if you eat a shovel full of concrete, you're going to your guts are going to fuse into a stone and you're going to die. The emu just passes them through.
Would you read that one, maybe?
Sure. Second essay on interest, the emu. Weathered blonde as a grass tree, a huge beetle's haircut, raises an alert periscope and stares out over scrub. Her large olivine eggs click oilily together, her lips of noble plastic clamped in their expression, her head fluff a stripe worn mohawk style. She bubbles her pale blue windpipe, the emu, Dromaeus novae hollandiae, whose stand-in on most continents is an antelope. Looks us in both eyes with her one eye and her other eye. Dignified, courageous hump. Feather swaying, condensed camel. Swift courser of New Holland. Knees backward in tooth three-way boots, you stand, dinner one, proud emu. Common as the dust in your sleeveless cloak. Returning our interest. Your shield of fashion's wobbly, your quaint, your native. Even somewhat bygone. You may be let live, but beware, the blank zones of serious disdain are often carte blanche to the darkly human. Europe's boats on their first strange shore looked humble, but mass over, men started renaming the creatures. Worship turned to interest and had new features. Now only life survives if it's made remarkable. Heraldic bird, our protection is a fable made of space and neglect. We're remarkable or not. We're the ordinary discovered on a strange planet. Are you early or late in the history of birds, which doesn't exist and is deeply ancient? My kinships too are immemorial and recent, like my country, which abstracts yours in words. This distillate of mountains is finely branched, this plain expanse of dour, delicate lives where the rain, shrouded slab on the west horizon, is a corrugated revenant, settling its long, clay-tipped plumage in a hatching descent. Rubberneck, stepsister, I see your eye on our jeep's load. I think your story is when you were offered the hand of evolution, you gulped it. Forefinger and thumb project from your face, but the weighing palm is inside you, collecting the bottle tops, nails, wet cement that you famously swallow. Your passing muffled show, your serially private museum. Some truths are now called trivial, though. Only God approves them. Some humans who disdain them make a kind of weather, which, when it grows overt and widespread, we call war. There we make death trivial and awesome by rapid turns about. We conscript it to bless us, force-feed it to squeeze the drama out. Indeed, we imprison and torture death. This part is called peace. And we offer it murder like mendicants, begging for significance. You rustle dreams of pardon, not fleeing in your hovercraft style, not gliding fast with zinc-flaked legs, dangling feet, making high tensile seesawing impacts. Wasteland parent, barely edible dignitary, the disinterested spotlight of the lords of interest and gowned nobles of ennui is a torch of vivid arrest and blinding after darkness. But you hint it's a brigand sovereignty after the steady extent of God's common immortality, whose image is daylight detail, aggregate in process, yet plumb to the everywhere focus of one devoid of boredom.
That's great.
I think that's our natural enemy, after all, boredom.
That's right.
Maybe I was approaching it. I was writing a bit long there.
Yeah, but I think there's a full quality to what you're trying to capture with.
Yeah, I was working out a whole nexus of thought.
Well, I love this idea of the wasteland parent, you call the emu.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we might turn to some of the Australian poets, the five fathers that are in your book, Five Fathers, but also Hell and After. How do you... you know, see them as these sort of, are they wasteland parents or are they quite different? You know, obviously they're different from each other, but when did you come to sort of represent them?
I first tried to represent these five fathers in a book for the English market. I thought the 19th century was, 19th and early 20th century was not a barren era in Australia. It was really quite productive. I was trying to show them the riches of a period of Australian literature from the 30s to the 60s, I guess. Australian literature as a discipline in universities was only just starting. I think it started in the University of Toulouse and moved to Moscow. The Soviets used to think we were promising people. So I made a fairly tight selection of each of those five. And they all had in common a certain richness of diction. And I thought that they might not be as experimental as American poets, but they had a great richness. That was their thing. The experimentalism came in the next generation, and it usually was second-rate or second-hand. It was America being imitated. But the second of those books, the one, Hell and After, was partly because of a remarkable chap, Frank the Poet McNamara, who was dimly remembered. And the communist sort of, an old communist chap, began putting together the surviving bits of Frank the Poet. And I thought this deserves to be widely known. Because Frank the Poet was a total recidivist. Australia, as you know, started as a British convict colony. And after America got its independence, the convicts had to be sent somewhere. And they began to be sent to New South Wales. And he was sentenced for 7 years and served 21 of them. He was repeatedly flogged because he couldn't restrain his witty tongue. And several very funny poems there, including the long one called A Convict's Tour to Hell, in which Frank goes down to hell expecting that that's where convicts go. And the devil said, oh, no, we never, we hate the poor, we never accept convicts. But if you like, you can come through and see who we do accept. Turned out that Hill consisted of well, the floggers and the jail administrators and the man who discovered Australia and the man who invented jails and all sorts of wonderful chaps having a very bad time. Yeah. And then Trank goes off to heaven, and St. Peter is a bit doubtful about him, but Jesus said, no, Peter, we're delighted. Frank's arrived at last. Job, go and kill the fatted calf. And it's going to be a wonderful feast. At that point, Frank wakes up, but... it's a sort of folk Dantesque, if you like, you know. And there were a number of other fine poets I thought I could put in there, particularly Mary Gilmore. She wasn't all as good, but where she was good, she hit some good notes. And she lived to be 100, no, she lived to be 99, and so had a wonderfully long writing career. And I liked her a lot. So she got in on that basis, and then a couple of other people as well. There's a lot of good stuff back there in the early parts of Australian settlement. And so I was trying to pick up on it and give handy, condensed views of it.
Yeah. Do you see the poet's role as this kind of, you know, reclamation and representing forefathers, foremothers, forebears?
It can be, yeah. It would not have been as well expressed without them. Yeah, you know. There was a tremendous tradition in the past, of course, of Aboriginal poetry. But that's largely a closed book for a couple of reasons. Most of it was never collected in a book form or a written form. And it's all the best of it is secret. It's religious secrecy. You have to be initiated to know it. And you're not supposed these days to borrow from it either. And that's just a very different way of doing art. You know, it's for the community, not that immediate community. It's not for general distribution. What is for general distribution is painting. Of all industry, there's only one Aboriginal industry and it's painting. And song, it's gradually creeping up too. The Aboriginal culture being utterly different from ours, it seems proceeding in a different kind of development.
One question I had was sort of about James Macaulay and also sort of Ern Malley, who's someone who I find fascinating. For those who don't know, he was a hoax poet.
A lot of people, he's the most famous of all Australian poets.
Well, of course, yes. Yeah. Not to me, but I think the poems written under his name by Macaulay. And what was his collaborators?
What was his name? Harold Stewart.
Yeah, Harold Stewart.
He went off to Kyoto and became a Zen monk.
That's right. During wartime, right? It's the 40s.
Yeah.
Tell me about, I don't know, either Malley or Macaulay or both.
Macaulay was a severe man. You would have seen it straight away from his face. He had a severe expression. He was a wonderful jazz player, apparently, on the piano. Brilliant student at Sydney University. And was rescued from the army by a fellow called Alf Conlon, who was kind of a behind-the-scenes string puller in the military circles. It was a scheme to get the best minds in Australia out of the army and into a place where they'd be safe. And Jim was one of them. And later he became an administrator in New Guinea, which was then an Australian colony. And one day in Victoria Barracks in Melbourne, he and Harold Stewart were sitting around with nothing much to do and decided to invent a modernist poet. They took all afternoon. Then they wrote a wonderful covering letter from his equally mythical sister, who said that she'd discovered these old poems. Maybe they would be of interest to somebody. And the letter was so beautifully composed in just the style of such a woman that it fooled everybody. And Max Harris was an editor of note in Australia at the time, and he was taken in completely. And the O'Malley poems became famous briefly until Stewart and Macaulay revealed the nature of the hoax. And then it went before a police court in case it was an obscenity. You know, these policemen said they didn't know what the devil it meant, but they thought it might just be obscene. And it's been hanging on ever since. One school of Australian poetry reveres O'Malley, and the other one tends to sniff at him. And I tend to laugh. I think it was a great joke and produced some good imagery.
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, I think it's funny and sometimes hilarious and, you know.
Yeah. Australia's full of, Australian artistic history is full of hoaxes. Whenever anything gets to be too fashionable, it tends to get sent up. And oh boy, does it get sent up.
Is that why you think they people hoax there, because just to send things up? Is it a particular Australian thing, you think?
Australia's a very collective culture and it doesn't believe in people getting ideas above their station. And if they do, they often find themselves cut down to size and ridiculed. And the method used is very ruthless hoaxing.
It's a fascinating chapter, I think. Turning back to your work, I was curious in your novel in verse, Freddie Neptune.
Oh, Freddie, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about him, it? It seems to me a like important demarcation in your work.
I was suffering badly from depression. Depression gave me a number of things. It gave me a set of poems about, or from the point of view of animals once, because I wanted to get out of my own head for a while. It was a bad place, my head. And Freddie was the biggest and best thing that came out of that. He appeared before my mind's eye and said, "I'm Fred Bircher, German-Australian. I lost my sense of touch because of something utterly shocking I saw. Write my story." And it was as if it was given all the way through. I thought, start writing this thing, and whenever it slid off and started to look a bit inauthentic, it wasn't Fred, I would rub that bit out and go back. I kept it on the line all the way. And I wrote about five chunks of about 4 months each, 4 or 5 months each, and then the rest of the year of meditating on it and getting it ready for the next book. And it came out. It was instantly rejected by the critics in Australia. They hated it. And I've never quite understood why. And the Germans and the Americans seemed to love it. The first place, though, it was translated was Norway.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know what their reaction was. I never saw any of the reviews at all.
Is there some of it you would read for us, or is there a part that you can excerpt?
Yeah, I could. You could open the book and start reading anyway.
Was that part of your design?
Well, it was designed not to be written in literary language at all, and it was the language of my father's youth. Early 20th century Australian, but spoken by a person who's bilingual and makes German mistakes and German jokes a bit. And, well, this probably would do. "He won't serve in the First World War, or indeed the Second, because he doesn't want to kill Germans or Australians, he being Berth." I think more people should take this in mind. You know, don't shoot your ancestors. In May, we reached Berlin. I should mention the "we" means Fred and a friend of his called Leland Golightly, who is a hermaphrodite. In May we reached Berlin. We had a sheaf of dates to play in Wedding, in Lichtenberg, in Pankow, none of the snob suburbs. On our first free night, Leland and I went, in spite of drizzle, to the centre of town to be impressed. "And when we get to Berlin," he muttered in tune, "the Kaiserie will say, 'Hoch, hoch, mein Gott, what a bloody woeful lot of the AIFHA.'" We were on the Spree Island, just passing the Royal Palace, and Leland was saying, "I think I'll sit the next war out as a little kept woman," when we heard yabba yabba, "Sieg Heil!" up ahead, over and over like surf, and saw a glow brightening. We hurried over the Schloss Bridge into Zeughausplatz, joined the edge of a great crowd there. "What's on?" "The students, they're burning all the Jew books and German hater books." We worked through to the steps of the Opera House for a view. "We burn you, Sigmund Freud, for your filthy incest theories that demean mankind. We burn you, Ernst Cassirer, for your corrosive Jew analysis of noble poetic thought. We burn you, Heinrich Heine." They heaped the books in armfuls to be shingles on a blazing house. Second time I'd seen books burnt, and this time it was official. "What's that big place they're carrying the books out of?" I asked Leland. "Seems it was the university." "Was? Well, it won't be now. Couldn't win its arguments. That's the public library next door, there where Goebbels are singing." He had a big bass voice for a pipe stem of a man. A lot in the crowd were hesitant about their Sieg Heiling, but scared of those that weren't. And I listened to a woman, These sows of scholar books have weighed us plain folk down, wrong-footed has got us killed. I'm glad to see them burn. Culture was always for Lord Muck to sneer and pose with. He don't work out in Copenhagen. Burn, you flattering shitbirds. But I noticed her arm didn't lift. A bone in her shoulder, perhaps, as old ladies used to say. And the crowd was dense. As we were leaving, students fronted us. You're English, yes? And we sang dumb. No, mate, we're Australian. You disapprove of burning books in Australia? If you have books there. I looked at Leland. Auntie Lula had a book, didn't she? She had three or four. There was one she dipped in water to give to sick cows. What Sex is the Eagle, it was called. By this stage, they dismissed us for idiots and waltzed off. There were hardly any words in my act, and I reckon the customers were just happy to see heaviness get lifted up where they might still walk out from under it. To me, the weights that volunteers strained at testing, plus all the motorbikes, anvils, park seats and people on them, were just like zeppelins. I laid hands on them, they took off and floated overhead as I filled them with my breath. Yeah, Fred is working as a strongman. Because he has lost his cutaneous sensation, the sensation in his skin, he can't feel how much effort costs and makes him very strong. And so he's working. He did it in Australia and he's doing it in Germany there. But that's the famous burning of the books in Berlin at that time. I didn't know, and I wish I had, that the city librarian of Berlin kept the Nazis out of the library. He didn't let them burn any of the books. He must have been a real hero, that one.
Yeah. Is Freddy for you a hero?
He is, in a funny way. He would probably not think such a thought. It would never cross his mind. But he is the hero of a book. And he sees a lot of the history of the first half of the 20th century. The book starts in 1914 and ends in the middle 40s, about 1949, when Fred gets his sensation back. And that's a mysterious chapter as well.
Well, do you think of it? I mean, you know, it's hard to think. The New York Times praises it as a haunting, loving, fiercely democratic epic by a master poet. I love this idea of the democratic epic. Are there other democratic epics you have in mind, either in Australia or in English?
Huckleberry Finn is one that I can think of. There are probably others. There's no sort of, or there are very few high-status people in Freddie Neptune. There's one very strange, quasi-medieval German noblewoman that he runs across at one point. Oh, and he runs across a few known people. I mean, he's a friend of Marlene Dietrich. And Marlene, as we all know, if she liked a man a bit, she would sleep with him. If she liked him a lot, she would cook for him. She really believed in food. She'd been hungry in her life, you know, and she knew about food.
Well, I love this idea of the democratic epic.
That's good.
I wonder if, turning to sort of your more recent work, after Conscious and Verbal, that's a book of recovery for you?
Yeah, very literally. I went into a coma because my gallbladder burst. And the little fellows that live inside you and which will eat you when you don't feed them anymore, they call it E. coli, they were eating my liver. It was the nicest thing they could find. And it was quite a job to turn them around and stop them doing it. And I came back by the skin of my teeth, more or less. And I thought, yeah, righto, from here on, I've had my death scene, I've had my rehearsal, the rest of life is now afterlife. Somebody had in the newspaper that the doctors had said at the hospital that I was now conscious and verbal. And I thought, that is a God's gift for a book title.
I love that title. I love Taller When Prone, too. That's a great...
Oh, yeah. I've always been if I may boast, a reasonable inventor of titles.
Oh, yeah. I've been learning human, subhuman, redneck poems.
That was, I was going to call it just redneck poems, but wasn't offensive enough. I had to strengthen it. Subhuman redneck poems.
Tell us about that.
I was a bit of a defender of poor people and unprivileged people in Australia. And the ones I come from, and this was despised by some of the fiercer intellectuals that defended rednecks and creatures of that sort. And I thought, make a virtue of it. the book, one of only two of mine that got on the Sydney Morning Herald's bestseller list.
That's amazing.
For a poetry book, I'd say it's unusual.
Yeah, I wonder what's the place of poetry in Australian life. Is it, you know, like in Ireland, for instance, poetry feels like a very daily thing for, you know, your cabbie knows poems. Is there that kind of connection to poetry?
It's partly because of the Irish that it is so in Australia. Well, not for everybody by any means, but there is a tradition of that sort. It tends to be a bit narrowed into one kind of poetry, but the Welsh are good at commentary verse too, and I've been very impressed by their model of poetry. There's a lot of people in Australia consume poetry, and they don't talk about it much, but they'll congratulate you, you know, sidelong somewhere. And that'll suit me. I like that. I'd hate to be famous like a rock star or a celebrity. That would be horrendous. They'd eat you alive.
Yeah. There's a poem by William Matthews where he says it's called Oxymorons, and one of them for him is a famous poet, which I always thought was quite funny. Turning back to your afterlife, as you said, tell us more about, you know, has your poetry changed for you?
I've been much more experimental, teaching myself to do various things. And I'll read you a couple of little poems, if I may.
Sounds perfect.
Now, one is related to America and to critics. And it refers to their civil war, but now I'm here in America, I'd have to say your civil war. I wrote a little haiku titled The Springfields. Lead drips out of a burning farm rail, their civil war. Critics didn't like it, said that it was obscure. The title was the rifle both American sides bore. The lead was the heavy bullet, the Minié, which tore, often wet with blood and cera, into the farmyard timbers and forests of that era. Wood that, burnt even now, might still remelt and pour out runs of silvery ichor the size of wasted semen it had annulled before. And, like a lot of foreigners, I'm a bit fascinated by the Civil War. Now, another one altogether. The Conversations. Just, you know, the sheer joy we have in bits of knowledge we exchange with each other. The Conversations. A full moon always rises at sunset, and a person is taller at night. Many fear their phobias more than death. The glass king of France feared he'd shatter. Chinese eunuchs kept their testes in spirit. Your brain can bleed from a sneeze breath. A full moon always rises at sunset, and a person is taller when prone. Donald Duck was once banned in Finland because he didn't wear trousers. His loins were feather-girt like daisies, but no ostrich hides its head in sand. The cure for scurvy was found, then long lost through medical theory. The beginning is a steady white sound. The full moon rises at sunset, and lemurs and capuchin monkeys pass a millipede round to get off on its powerful secretions. Mouthing it, they wriggle in bliss on the ground. The heart of a groomed horse slows down. A fact is a small, compact faith, a sense datum to beasts, a power to man, even if true, even while true. We read these laws in Isaac Neuron. One woman had 69 children. Some lions mate 50 times a day. Napoleon had a victory addiction. A full moon always rises at sunset. Soldiers can now get in the family way.
Interesting. I love that.
Well, I'm not for nothing the father of an autistic child, you see. That one thing about autists, they literally love fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always loved fact too. I didn't realise that I was a bit of an autistic. I was an only child off a farm was all I knew, but that is a fairly autistic position to be in. And I thought I'd have a bit of fun with all my factual knowledge.
Yeah, it all seems connected, though. I mean, not in this poetics that you've created, I feel.
Oh,
like.
Yeah. I'm always trying out new poetics to see how they work. And can we make this work? Yeah, that worked. No, that one's not doing the right thing.
You mentioned in the poem you just read, Faith, and your poems seem to have, you know, certainly your collected poems is a, and I think the new poems too is To the Glory of God.
Yeah.
Is that something you know feel
it's
comfortable talking about? Or
it's a thing I don't know a hell of a lot about, but I have written on it a few times. There's one little poem that probably illustrates it better than the others, called Church. Yeah, I turned Catholic when I was, effectively when I was about 18, and joined up when I was about 24, and never mentioned it to my father. I was a bit shy of it because he and Mum were fiercely anti-Catholic, but he never mentioned it either, so the next 40 years until he died, it never came up in conversation. Now, where are you, Church? The wish to be right has decamped in large numbers, but some come to God in hopes of being wrong. High on the end wall hangs the gospel from before he was books. All judging ends in his fix, all, including his own. He rose out of Jewish, not English evolution, and he said the lamp he held aloft to all nations was Jewish. Freedom still eats freedom, justice eats justice, love, even love. One retarded man said, "Church makes me want to be naughty." But naked in a muddy trench with many thousands, someone saying, "The true God gives his flesh and blood. Idols demand yours off you."
The only other poem I want to mention that I particularly love, and especially because you mentioned your father, is that poem, The Last Hellos.
Yeah.
To me, that's one of my favorite poems, period. And I read, it was in this elegy anthology I did, The Art of Losing, and I would read from it, you know, because I think it's so powerful about, well, I mean, wrestling with goodbye, but as a kind of hello.
I'll read it for you if you like.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Tell you a sad story about him after that. The last hellos. Don't die, Dad, but they die. This last year he was wandery. Took off a new chainsaw blade and cobbled a spare from bits. Perhaps if I lay down, my head'll come better again. His left shoulder kept rising higher in his cardigan. He could see death in a face. Family used to call him in to look at sick ones and say. At his own time, he was told. The knob found in his head was duck egg size. Never hurt. 2 to 6 months, Cecil. "I'll be right," he boomed to his poor sister on the phone. "I'll do that when I finish dying." Don't die, Cecil, but they do. Going for last drives in the bush, odd, massive, bored, slotted stumps, bony, white in whipstick second growth. I could chop all day. I could always cash a check in Sydney or anywhere, any of the shops. Eating, still at the head of the table, he now missed food on his knife side. "Sorry, Dad, but like, have you forgiven your enemies, your father and all them, all his lifetime of hurt?" "I must have," grin. "I don't think about that now." People can't say goodbye anymore, they say last hellos. Going fast over Christmas, he'd still stumble out of his room where his photos hang over the other furniture and play host to his mourners. The courage of his bluster, firm big voice of his confusion. 2 last days in the hospital, his long forearms were still red mahogany. His hands gripped steel frame. "I'm dying. On the second day, you're busting to talk, but I'm too busy dying." Grief ended when he died. The widower, like soldiers who won't live life their mates missed. "Good boy, Cecil, no more bluey dog, no more cow time, no more stories. We're still using your imagination. It was stronger than all ours. Your grave's got littler somehow in the 3 months, more pointy as the clay is shriveled like a stuck zip in a coat. Your cricket boots are in the State Museum. Odd letters still come. 2 more's died since you, Annie and Stuart, old Stuart. On your day there was a good crowd, family and people from away, but of course a lot had gone to their own funerals first. Snobs mind us off religion nowadays if they can. Fuck them. I wish you God."
That's beautiful.
That got me a certain amount of trouble, that last line. It's the most notorious line in Australian literature, that one.
How do they argue with it? I mean...
It's very improper and very, very undignified and shouldn't have done it. Come here and accept a whack across the hand.
But you're writing about such, you know, about grief and loss and...
I'm also writing in the language Dad and I spoke to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slightly different dialect from the regular round of, or city speech anyway. It's a bit more old-fashioned. You'd be surprised how hard it was to get some of those things printed. They would correct the grammar every time, and you'd have to correct it back out of correct.
Right, right. Well, in the spokenness, I think that's one of the things, hearing you read it, but also that when I read it first, that strikes me is... is that spoken quality that I think courses through all your work and really is this human language, you know, as opposed to some ideal language, you know. And I love that you call your selected poems learning human, you know. There's something really human and humane about that.
Yeah, good. I like that. I remember that very nice lunch that my English publisher and my American publisher had with me in London the day we invented that one. They said, in America, we never call a book Selected Poems. We want a proper title. I said, how about Learning Human? Oh, yes, everybody loved that, so you know. But no, my father, poor fellow, he had a disaster which caused a lot of fellow on disaster in the family. He refused to cut a tree down for his father, who was his employer and landlord. Devious old alcoholic, he called upon Dad's next brother down to come and cut this tree. It was rotten, you see, it wasn't worth anything. It was hard to get down. And the younger brother, Archie, cut it down, and it cut him down. It fell on him and killed him. And so Dad and his father had this terrible subterranean battle all the rest of their lives. And the grandfather, who owned the farm we were on, kept Dad and Mum poor as a punishment.
That's tough.
It's a grim little story, that one. It took me a long time to work it out. What's going on? Why are they so angry, you know?
Do you ever write about the incident?
I did only fairly recently. I finally sorted it out. I knew most of the elements, but I didn't know how they joined up. Because Dad, instead of telling me about it and saying this is what caused us to be poor, expected me to work it out for myself, and if I hadn't, I was stupid, you know.
Well, I come from a long line of farmers, and I can see that, you know, people don't tell you how things happen necessarily.
Yeah, they're strange that way. The deepest things go unexplained. You know, people talk about Catholic guilt. I tell you, there's one that's as bad, and that's Presbyterian blame. Dad and his father went in for Presbyterian blame.
Wow.
They never forgave each other. Until Dad couldn't remember that he had forgiven. He said, I must have. Because his brain, you know, had a tumour in it.
Yeah.
And I was rejoiced to hear that. I thought, well, on whatever terms, I'm glad that nightmare's over.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you write about it so beautifully, and about family and faith and place and home and, you know, the future.
No wonder they call me a redneck.
That was Les Murray speaking with Kevin Young. This program was recorded at the Poetry Foundation in Chicago on April 25th, 2013, as part of International Poets in Conversation, and was sponsored by the Harriet Monroe Poetry Institute. Les Murray is the author of over 30 collections of poetry, most recently Killing the Black Dog, A Memoir of Depression, Taller When Prone, and The Biplane Houses. He's also written numerous collections of essays and other prose, two novels in verse, and is the editor of several poetry anthologies. Kevin Young is currently Atticus Haygood Professor of Creative Writing and English, and curator of literary collections and the Raymond Danowski Poetry Library at Emory University in Atlanta. His next volume of poems, Book of Hours, is forthcoming from Knopf. You can learn more about Les Murray and Kevin Young and read some of their poetry by visiting poetryfoundation.org, where you'll also find articles by and about poets, an online archive of more than 10,000 poems, the Harriet blog about poetry, the complete back issues of Poetry Magazine, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.